This is Triad Arts Weekend. On June 19, 1865, the enslaved in Galveston, Texas, the last place in America where slavery existed, learned of their freedom for the very first time. Just 1 month earlier, at what we now know today as the St. Philip's Church in Old Salem, Union troops arrived to enforce President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation there. The Union chaplain read General Order No. 32. To remove the doubt in the minds of the people of North Carolina that all persons held as slaves are now free. This year is the 150th anniversary of that monumental announcement. Juneteenth, the country's longest-running observance of the abolition of slavery, continues this month in Winston-Salem, compliments of Triad Cultural Arts. Old Salem Museums and Gardens Director of African American Programming, Cheryl Harry.
We know there was singing. We know the scripture that the chaplain spoke from that day. We know what was said by the people who were announcing, but we don't have the response of the people who heard it.
But we're keeping it alive here.
Okay, yes.
This is really bringing together the past and present in a neat way.
Right, yeah. Because a lot of people of African descent can't actually say, you know, I'm a native of Senegal, or I can trace my ancestry back. This is how we sort of just, we know that we all from the continent, but we can all come together and rally around this as we think about, you know, the Middle Passage, everybody coming over, people just thrown together from different tribes, you know, and then we sort of just end up here and we mail together in some kind of way. So it is our homecoming. It's our bringing together all of those different nationalities, all of the different bloodlines together and just celebrating.
What's it like being in that, just proximity-wise and being surrounded with that energy?
You know what? People have such a sense of pride and connection when they get to the festival. It's a bond there. And people feel good about being together. I don't know if the blood begins to mix and boil some kind of way, but we all can sort of accept and coalesce around that one bloodline that we know that would date us all back to the continent.
And you're going to be celebrating through music and food and visual art and interactive activities and some performances coming up. What sorts of sounds for starters?
Well, for starters, you're going to hear some what we call African folk music. The Healing Force is going to be there. And they have all kinds of great music that they do. You'll hear the drums. You'll hear the balafone.
And the balafone is that, it's like a vibraphone, but made out of wood?
I call it a xylophone, it's sort of. But yeah, but it's made out of wood.
Yeah, and, gorgeous sound.
Yeah. You also get to hear some jazz. We're putting together what we call the Juneteenth Jazz Band. So it's going to be local musicians from all over. Otesha Creative Arts Ensemble is going to be there. That's another African group. And if you want to dance and move to the music, you need to be there for that as well. Of course, gospel. You know, that's our foundation. So we have two of the greatest gospel choirs in Winston-Salem, the Big Four, and the Renaissance Choir is going to be there as well. So I think you're going to hear a little drumming, and when you hear the music, if the rhythm makes you move, you can move. but it's going to be a wide cultural experience.
This is dedicated to the one
we're going to do a special tribute to the Five Royales. As you know, they've just been inducted into the Rock and Roll Music Hall of Fame.
That's right.
And we're going to play their music during the day as well and really do a special tribute. Their family members are going to be there. Memorabilia will be on display as well.
And with the Five Royales, we're going back to the 50s in Winston-Salem. Where do they come from?
The Pond. That's the neighborhood I grew up in. And in Winston-Salem, the Pond, Trade Street, Northwest Boulevard, most of them were in that area, Kimberly Park area, so they would have been in the neighborhood called the Pond. They, of course, came from the church. I was just with their son. We were watching the induction, and they actually started out as a gospel group. I think they were called the Royal Sons. The grandfather named the group the Royal Sons. And then when they sort of switched over to secular, they became the Five Royales.
Huge impact on the entire music industry. The music goes hand in hand with the great food, and you've got a variety of culinary treats heading our way. What are some of those?
Okay, you must have fried fish. Got to have fried fish at the Juneteenth. And you got to have ribs, and we'll have that. We're also going to have some chicken an array of chicken wings. Every kind of way you can eat a chicken wing, you'll be able to do that. We're going to have turkey, and we're going to have the ices and ice cream, and of course, good sweet potato pie. So you got to beat it.
Nice.
Oshé, oh baba, oshé, oh baba.
In terms of visual art, what will we be seeing?
Now, we're going to have a lot of historical displays there. Delta Art Center will be there working with the kids, so they'll be able to do a make-and-take art project as well. We're going to have the quilting. The Durham Quilters Society will be there. And you're going to actually be able to make a quilt square. They're going to teach you how to do that. And you can make your own little quilt square and take that home with you as well. What we're really excited about is that we're going to have an exhibit from the Mendenhall Plantation Museum in Jamestown. They're actually going to bring the slip wagon, you know, where slaves would be hidden under the wagon, where they had the draw under slip. He's going to have a model of that there. Whereas as well, we're going to have lots of displays, African-American history and cultural displays, magazine articles, newspapers, artifacts, all kinds of things. We've gotten this great exhibit from the Gilda Lerman Foundation. It's called Emancipation and Its Legacies. So it's about a 10-foot display that will take you from the 1800s up till 1963, as we talk about civil rights.
In 1963, what a pivotal year. And you've got a visiting author, guest speaker, who really encapsulates all that with his most recent book, Reverend Byron Williams, your featured literary guest this year. Last year, his best-selling book, 1963, The Year of Hope and Hostility, won the International Book Award for U.S. History.
We are so excited to be able to have Reverend Williams as a part. He actually lives in Winston-Salem now. We're going to do what we call the Freedom Ceremony as well. So we wanted to read the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment as a part of that. So I thought about, well, why can't we get Reverend Byron to really expound on these amendments and what they really mean? So he's going to be there to read those three amendments to the Constitution, and then he'll sort of expound on each one of those amendments and what it really means to us and what we need to be doing going forward. He's also starting this think tank in Winston-Salem called the Kairos Think Tank. It's going to be an African-American think tank, so he'll be there to talk about that as well. He's going to have a display there, so I hope people will come out for that.
That sounds really interesting. This is a person with such a historical grasp. In the summation of the book, 1963 was the year America lost the illusion of innocence. It was a year that began with George Wallace declaring segregation today, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever, and concluded with Martin Luther King being named Time Magazine's Man of the Year. All that going on at the same time in this country, it really says volumes.
It really does. I concur. We're actually celebrating the 150th anniversary of the ending of slavery. So we wanted to really make it big this year. So we're going to have an extended stage. We're going to have, in between stage dances, we're going to have community line dances so that everybody can just come and celebrate. And, you know, you just jump into the line dance and you just start moving. You don't have to know the steps. We're going to have historical exhibits. We're going to have quilting. Of course, I mentioned the Mendenhall Plantation is going to be there. We're going to have a kids area. We're actually doing a puppet show, the Old Salem Heirloom Puppet Theater. We're going to do The Night the Portrait Spoke, which is a Juneteenth show as well. And we're going to have that for the kids. Delta's going to be there doing arts and crafts with the kids. We're going to have activity sheets for the kids. We're going to have one of the most, I think, dynamic spoken word artists in the country, Eurydice White. She is absolutely fabulous. She does a lot of spoken word here, and she's done a piece that's international on the web. One of her works was selected for that. We're going to have great food. We're going to have dancing in the streets. We're going to have sidewalk art. It's just going to be a grand time.
Cheryl Harry, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you so much.
Juneteenth organizer Cheryl Harry. The 11th annual Juneteenth Africana Festival of the Triad will be held in Winston-Salem on Saturday, June 20th from 11 to 6 at 5th Street and MLK Junior Drive. There'll be African dance, storytelling, exhibits, kid areas, food trucks, music, and more. For more information, go to our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, next up, it's time for Film Studies with Eddie Garcia. Today, he'll be delving into the dark with a look at film noir at SICA.
The Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, SICA, is stepping into the shadows. Their retreat from the light is in honor of film noir. Now, film noir is a genre known for bleak detective stories, fog, femme fatales, moral dilemmas, and criminal activity. The first annual Going Dark film noir screening series ignites the silver screen of SICA on June 11th. Films showing include The Killing, The Asphalt Jungle, and Alfred Hitchcock's The Wrong Man. Now, film noir can be a little tricky to define, but Alex Brown, SICA Program's coordinator and curator of the series, is here to clear the smoke. What is film noir?
It's a type of film that emerged post-World War II. It emerged in reaction to this anxiety, this deep-felt anxiety throughout the country after the war, where people were living in this world that was no longer safe. Like, after this huge worldwide war, and afterwards, there's this anxiety that, you know, all this bad stuff has happened, and bad stuff can continue to happen. And so this is kind of the environment that film noir emerged in. And now, unlike other film genres, for example, westerns or musicals, that fit into this very tight definition, film noir is very far from a conventional genre. And it's less of a traditional genre, and it's more of a tone or a mood that defines what film noir is.
So it's more of the style or the look and feel of the film than necessarily the type of story?
Exactly. So there are a lot of film noir that are based on crime, criminal stories. Of course, famously, when people think of film noir, they think of Private Eyes and detectives. But that's not always the case. You get people on both sides of the law. You have criminals that are featured as the main players, and then you have detectives or down-and-out police officers. It is less defined by the story and more of this general tone of bleakness, darkness, disillusionment, anxiety, paranoia. All of these really dark emotions and dark moods are what define film noir as far as the tone. To complement this tone, film noir movies also have low-key lighting, and the editing, the way these films are cut and edited, are done in such a way to create disorientation. So there's a lot of film noir movies that are shot out of order. So they're non-linear stories that are being told. And so that creates this sense of confusion in the viewer.
One of the films that has that non-linear style, it's actually the last film, which I remember when I saw this, I guess when I was in high school, I was like, oh, this really, this is a huge influence on Reservoir Dogs, as The Killing, which early Stanley Kubrick film. Tell us about The Killing a little bit and about kind of the jigsaw structure of that.
What makes The Killing unique, and it also makes it a very good example of film noir, is that at its core, it's a heist movie, but it's also a film noir. It's a ragtag group of criminals, and they are essentially going to pull a heist at a racetrack. And so you have someone that works at the racetrack, you have a boxer and a wrestler that are going to be involved in creating a distraction, and you have all these different moving parts. And the disjointed structure comes from the fact that you're seeing all these different relationships develop throughout the film. And you don't really know how they're going to play with one another from the beginning.
I know, like, these film noir films of the 40s and 50s really influenced a lot of French films, a lot of, kind of the French New Wave filmmakers, mm-hmm. and influenced, as you were saying, so many movies into the future. I'm curious about, though, how were they received when they first were released? It seems like we look at film noir very reverentially now, and filmmakers really do.
So when film noir first came out, the term film noir was actually coined by a French film critic. And at the time, he coined the phrase, but no one used it. It was just written in some obscure French periodical, and it just kind of sat there until it was rediscovered later on. Now, at the time, once again, unlike Westerns and musicals, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when a director was setting out to make a film, they're like, well, I'm going to make a Western.
So there were certain marks the movie had to hit.
Yeah, there were these very particular marks. Okay, I'm making this type of film. Film noir is a bit different because the term didn't come into wide usage until well after film noir was established. And so when these directors were making the films in the 40s and 50s, they were really seen as melodramas. They were seen as a detective movie. They weren't seen as film noir. And it wasn't until later in the late 50s and early 60s when they started tossing around the idea of what a film noir is. Because at that point, there were so many films that had come out and they'd established this toehold in the movie industry. And right around the time when they started to define the film is when the film noir kind of dropped off and was replaced by these generally brighter films. And by brighter, I mean physically, they were actually brighter. Like the movies themselves had more light and
Technicolor.
More color. Exactly, Technicolor.
Right.
It brings us to another point about film noir is that a lot of people think that a film noir has to be a black and white film. A black and white is a integral part of what a film noir movie is. That's only the case because when these movies came out, all movies were pretty much in black and white. And so it was kind of a built-in aspect of these films. As time moved on, you get neo-noir films, you have tech noir, sci-fi noir, all these other variations on noir that are still at the core of film noir, but they don't have that black and white scheme.
So that's anything from Blade Runner to No Country for Old Men or like Nightcrawler recently released.
And so Blade Runner is probably the most famous example of a sci-fi or a tech noir film. It's 100% science fiction. It's set in the future. There's robots, replicants. But at the same time, it's 100% film noir movie. It's dark. It's gritty. The main character is this downtrodden, kind of defeated detective, essentially. And so it's both of these things at the same time. That's a unique element of film noir, is that it can be overlaid onto all these different existing genres. I was thinking about this earlier, that Christopher Nolan, who's made a lot of popular movies lately, and he's made The Batman Begins, he's did Memento, The Following, Inception. All of these films have heavy, heavy references to film noir. I mean, Batman Begins is a film noir movie. I mean, it's dark, gritty. It's about a brooding hero who's trying his best to fix things, but he just keeps hitting walls and he keeps failing. And no matter what, he can't win. And so that is something that you find in a lot of these film noir movies. Now, if the star would be a criminal or a convict or a detective, all these characters go through this same thing where they're trying so hard to make their lives better. But because of circumstances beyond their control, they can't. They get pulled back into that criminal element, or they get taken down by someone stronger than them, and they just can't fight it.
So the first screening is on Thursday, June 11th, and it's the film Double Indemnity.
This is considered by many to be the first true film noir movie. Looking back and looking at films that came later, there's a lot of later film noir movies that pulled elements straight out of Double Indemnity. And one of the most popular being The Femme Fatale. In this case, it's played by Barbara Stanwyck, who is manipulating the main star of the film to murder her husband for her. The reason she is doing this is the namesake for the film, Double Indemnity. And what this refers to is an insurance clause where it states that if someone dies in a very particular manner, then it doubles the payout for that insurance. In this case, if her husband is murdered, then her insurance payout doubles.
We're both rotten.
Only you're a little more rotten. You got me to take care of your husband for you. And then you get Cicchetti to take care of Lola. Maybe take care of me too. Then somebody else would have come along to take care of Zucchetti for you. That's the way you operate, isn't it, baby?
Suppose it is. Is what you've got cooked up for tonight any better?
And so the femme fatale is this sensual female character that's very manipulative, and it's a characteristic that's found in many film noir movies, and it's found in many of the films featured in the film noir series. They're constantly taking advantage of these weak men. And by weak, I mean they could be insecure, they could just be downtrodden, they could be beaten, they could be defeated by life. And then this beautiful woman comes into their life with promises of making it better, but she's just manipulating that person for her own benefit. And this is another element that we find in, it's in The Killing, and it's in The Big Heat, and it's in many, many, many film noir movies.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it.
So the next screening is the Billy Wilder film Thunder Road on June 18th.
Thunder Road, this film I chose because I wanted to feature a film noir movie that kind of spoke to the region that we're in now. And this film, it takes place in Appalachia, and it follows the story of Robert Mitchum, who plays a young moonshiner. And he works for his father running alcohol through the Appalachians.
Just exactly who is this Colgan fellow, Papa?
Oh, Mr. Colgan is a man with a big idea. Wants to combine all the stills in the valley, take all our makings. Special guarantee is $4,000 a week.
Well, he's free with his money. Maybe not so free either.
And it's kind of a different take on film noir, because when people think about film noir, other than detectives and dark colors, back alleys and all these dark places, they usually imagine them in a city. Thunder Road is different. So it's a film noir movie. It has all of these same dark elements, but it takes place in the mountains.
Does a modern audience need to step back, kind of put themselves in another time to some degree to appreciate these classic film noirs? I only ask that because so many social norms and gender and racial representations were different then.
I think the elements that are going to stand out the most to a modern audience are the gender relationships. They're rough and they're not very even. The men are very domineering, but then on the flip side, there are women that are truly in control of some of these films. Like, they're in the back, but they're also portrayed as manipulative when they're not weak. Or they're wedged into these archetypes. They're sensual and manipulative, or they're weak and a distraction. So they're used as part of the story, whereas the men are typically leading the action in the stories. Now, that's not the case for all these films, but that's definitely the part that's going to stand out the most. Now, what's nice about these and what makes it easy for modern audiences, so a moviegoer that's never seen a film noir movie, they're going to recognize immediately the motives of these characters. I mean, they're very simple human motives, and they're very real problems that they deal with. So there's a lot of crime, and the crime is based on desperation. And I think everyone can relate to feeling desperate at some point in their life. And so that is an access point for people for these movies that, yeah, they're set in the 40s and they're set in the 50s, but the motives for all these characters are motives that are still around today, and they still motivate a lot of the crime. It's the same motives. It doesn't change. There's people in these films that are doing things for love, horribly misguided. There are men that are doing something to gain the love of a woman who has no intention of loving him back whatsoever, and vice versa. And that's something that we can all relate to. And so there are all these elements throughout these films that you just immediately recognize.
SICA Programs Coordinator Alex Brown. The Going Dark Film Noir screening series starts in glorious black and white on Thursday, June 11th at 8 p.m. with a screening of Double Indemnity. Thunder Road screens on June 18th, and The Big Heat, directed by German expressionist cinema master Fritz Lang, screens on June 25th. The series runs through July 16th, and you'll find a complete schedule at WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll return with chamber music from Bach to Brunhilde, banjo, and beyond after this short break. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Cellist and educator Grace Anderson is celebrating 10 years as artistic director of the Triad Chamber Music Society in Winston-Salem. Violinist and educator Sarah Johnson began chamber music on the Hill, Seamoth, more than 25 years ago on the campus of the then School of the Arts. The two have collaborated together with both organizations, teaching young people the musical and non-musical lessons found through chamber music study, rehearsals, games, and performances. This year, Seamoth, a three-week chamber music camp, will be held on the Wake Forest University campus.
Chamber music as a way of growing up for the younger generation was really important to me. And also my daughter was starting to play the violin, and I saw that playing together with others was so crucial. And yet a lot of young folks go from their music lessons to their practice rooms and maybe once a week get to play in an orchestra. But even then, there's not a lot of collaboration in terms of just putzing around and having their own say. So I started this chamber music program called the Young Performers Workshop 10 years ago. And I think Sarah was on board already then. And I saw that even the first year, my pilot year, the 20 or so kids that came knew how to collaborate together, and everybody felt like they owned the music. So they were trying to do their best in front of their peers. And I saw that that was a really good, viable way to teach them and for them to hunger for more chamber music. Sometimes I'll be practicing and telling my little head, telling myself, do what you just preached. So from that perspective, selfishly, it helps me become a better musician. But I also love breaking down the music in terms of curating bigger pictures. It forces me to get to know the music itself intimately. Sarah came the first year to coach, and then year after year, then she would invite me to teach at Chamber Music on the Hill, which was then held at School of the Arts. And I saw that we share a lot of basic tenets in common, that we didn't just have the students play correctly, but we wanted to approach them as the whole musician. We wanted to ask questions like, well, you're playing so well in your practice room, but how come your nerves get in the way when you're on the stage? And we realized that a lot of times when students have practiced their pieces, they have to develop this intuition about what they're doing, this almost a biofeedback when they're performing. And when that's lacking, then a lot of things go out the window when you're on the stage. So Sarah in her camp then had these group classes she calls special topics classes. And basically students stand around and they have play theater games, improv games. They have to think on their feet.
We also talked about trust a lot and building trust. And most of our students are teenagers. So that, you know, most teenagers are a little bit self-conscious, I think people would think. And so part of that issue of breaking down the wall between them and the audience or them and their peers is an element of trust. So we did trust games. And I got a lot of these things from my fellow theater colleagues, both at the School of the Arts and at the South Carolina Governor School.
Give me an example of where you have seen the fruits of the trust games labor play out musically.
Grace is going to jump in.
Okay, Grace, you've got a story.
Okay, this is going to be regarding a violist. Her name is Tara. They play this gorgeous piece, the Smetana String Quartet, which starts out with a huge viola solo. And she played very, very well, but she didn't play anywhere near forte or fortissimo, whatever the marking is, which meant play as loud as you can. So in master classes, we had her play louder. So eventually, one of the teachers in the master class, and now, mind you, this is all in front of 30 other students there, we asked her to please stand up and then stand up on top of a chair and play her solo. So physically, her height was above everybody else. And then to follow through with her bow, and it didn't matter if she scratched. And so in some ways, the audience was there as her guinea pig to see, well, let's see how much risk you can take without being made fun of. And that changed her playing completely. And from then on, whenever she approached that solo, she just played with abandon. And in fact, after that summer, she had applied for college. In her college essay, she wrote, that summer changed her life. And it made her come out of her shell.
That's a great story. I can really see that. Because after you have performed in front of your peers, standing in an awkward position up on a chair, anything after that would be easy.
You realize you're naked in the first place.
Sarah, I studied with an old school teacher. You had to wear a suit and tie to go to lessons and kind of a student guru sort of dynamic. But you talk about immersive, supportive, creative, individually designed education and this notion of indirect teaching methods. Let's start there. What about indirect teaching methods? What's that all about?
I wonder if I need to back up and talk about the cult teacher, which I certainly grew up under the same kind of paradigm with the great Ivan Galamian. And it's nuts and bolts and it's Russian school and that became Franco-Belgian school and blah, blah, blah.
And by cult teacher, you mean they say it and you just do it.
You got it. These are the fingerings. These are the bowings. This is how you play it. And then as I went off in my own world, I wasn't trained pedagogically as many students are now with Suzuki teaching, or you're an apprentice to your own teacher in that sort of cult teaching style. I didn't have the benefit of any of that. So I had to kind of synthesize all of the incredible training that I received. And I came from two completely different schools of violin playing. I started out in the Leopold Auer School, and then I went to the Galamian School. Mm. And so already right there, setting up this synthesis.
And Leopold Auer, the fellow for whom the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto was written.
Yes, and my teacher was a student of his.
How about that?
I know.
That's a great lineage.
I'm telling you.
And Yasha Heifetz.
Yep. Indirect teaching, I just had to do a lot of by tuition and feel. I had all the nuts and bolts I could easily pass on. You know, this is how you do these exercises for 5 hours a day, 6 days a week, 8 weeks every summer, you know, and you do these insanely mind-numbing physical things like the dancers and the ice skaters have to do. But then how do you find the music within the written page? How does it yield to you? And that's one of those things you can't really, really say. You know, we would talk about just the shape on the page sometimes with students if they were kind of stodgy and say, well, what does that look like? Does that look like a mountain or does that look like a, you know, a lake? And then when you hear this chord, well, does it feel like a color or, you know, along the lines of the synesthesia of Olivier Messiaen and Scriabin? So gradually we started finding this other way of talking about music and sound. That was the basis of this indirect approach.
It takes me back to so many teachers in the music school put an emphasis on singing, even if you were playing an oboe or a string instrument, which was not vocal. That sort of indirectness then led to a vocalization on the instrument.
That's absolutely what we do, too, is you always have to sing whatever it is you're doing, even if you just sort of croak around. And I croak in front of them in this really dismal voice, which pitches aren't even recognizable sometimes, but that also allows them the freedom and the courage to go ahead and give it a try. So I don't ever try to impress my students.
So they can jump back up on that chair and play.
I think the key words here are courage and imagination. To bring out that imagination that they had in the first place about the music so that after all the technical details are worked out, that they can still bring that out.
Tell me, Grace, some of the non-musical lessons, we'll call them, learned through chamber music study and rehearsal and performance.
One is how to unleash your confidence. We all have confidence. And also, overcoming nervousness. That's a biggie. I think no matter what the age is, I often get students or their parents pulling me aside saying, well, now, my son can do very well, but, you know, he has a nerves problem. And I said, well, you know, he's not unique, and I'm part of that, too. So in chamber music, we get them to focus so much on their role in the bigger picture that there's really no room to be nervous when they're performing with their colleagues.
Cooperation, learning how to cooperate, learning how to communicate directly and clearly.
As in rehearsal and
yes.
Getting done what you want?
And in the performances. You know, sometimes somebody's in real dire straits. They're in the wrong page or something like that, and you can't stop. So you have to everybody has to have a new way of communicating with their eyes, with their bodies. Once in a blue moon, somebody might go, let her see. But it's always serving the music and the experience for the listener as well.
Another one I can think of is knowing that there is time for everything that you intend to do. I'm recalling a particular masterclass we had last summer of a Beethoven quartet, and they were playing a scherzo movement where the first violinist, she had, you know, very fast notes and everybody else had very, very calm notes. So she was the jester of the whole thing. And when she had to take a deep breath and go right back in, we told her to give an audience a wink. And so she did that. And that was a really valuable lesson because it was like, you know, even though you have the most number of notes, we are here for you. You have all the time in the world to tell us your notes.
The maximum value for every note. I'm a believer. So what sorts of outreach activities does the Triad Chamber Music Society offer?
Let's see. After this past fall, I had our students perform at the Baptist Hospital at the cancer wing. And just one thing after another. And we hope to do more of that.
We used to do this thing way years ago in the camp, which I did at the School of the Arts, which we called COPS, Community Outreach Program by Students for Students' Summer Scholarships. And the students were really enthused, and we would go out and play some retirement community or something like that. And that retirement community would give us, $100, $200 contribution to our scholarship fund.
Oh, that's nice.
So we will continue to do that sort of thing. We also, last year, we love this sort of naval acronyms, are they called? But anyway, we had RACRAM, which is Random Acts of Culture and Random Acts of Music. And these kids put on their little green T-shirts identifying themselves as chamber musicians. And they went downtown and were buskers. And actually, we let them keep the money that they raised for those things. But anyway,
nice.
We'll do more of that sort of stuff. Kind of guerrilla chamber music warfare. We pop up here, we pop up there.
violinist Sarah Johnson and cellist Grace Anderson. Chamber Music on the Hill, the three-week, rigorous, and concentrated summer program that integrates the study of chamber music with solo performance, is June 14th through July 3rd, and applications for commuters are being accepted through June 10th. Student, faculty, and alumni concerts are free and open to the public, and you'll find more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, time for a short break, and then we're back with Mean Mary. She'll be visiting the Triad courtesy of the Fiddle and Bow Society, and it's an appropriate visit indeed. Mary plays not only fiddle and all things bowed, she's also an outstanding guitarist, banjo picker, singer-songwriter, and much more. Next, after this short break. This is Triad Arts Weekend. Known around the world for her lightning-fast fingers on banjo, fiddle, and guitar, haunting vocals, and intricate story songs, Mary James, or Mean Mary as she's known, is the perfect fit for the Fiddle and Bow Society in Winston-Salem. Her original music nods in the direction of folk rock, bluegrass, and blues, but the skilled multi-instrumentalist has a truly unique musical voice that's all her own. We're sampling from Mean Mary's most recent album, Year of the Sparrow.
Comes and goes like summer rain, as flighty as a whooping crane, as restless as a weather vane, whoever art thou, James.
The Nashville-based artist and author has been entertaining audiences for as long as she can remember. Here's Mean Mary singing and playing guitar on Long Tall Texan for a television audience at the age of six.
And the iron horse is speeding creep.
Iron Horse just gallops right along, and then in come the real horses with the castanets. I mean, that was a great little touch.
Thank you. Thank you. My husband, he doesn't like that in the song. I'm like, I got to play my castanets because it's baby.
You paid for them. You might as well use them.
And that's right. I know how to play. I can play the heck out of a pair of castanets. Come on.
By the sea in the lee of the cliffs all alone, its pages were tattered from where it had blown to land from.
Your voice is so incredibly expressive, Mary. Your vocal range on this tune was really wide as well, and it strikes me as even more remarkable given the fact that at one point in your life you're working with just one of those vocal folds. How did you work through that injury? What did the doctor say? What exactly happened to your voice?
One of my vocal cords, when I hit the dashboard of the car in the accident, it paralyzed one of my vocal cords. Basically, there was no movement in one of my vocal cords. We didn't know at first. I couldn't talk. I could just whisper. And when we went to the specialist and stuff to look at it, he says, yeah, this one vocal cord is paralyzed. And because you have been a singer, my whole life and stuff, he said, you're able to talk now. At this point, I was able to talk because the one vocal cord is actually stretching all the way to meet, because your two vocal cords meet together to make sound. And it was actually the one vocal cord was having to go all the distance to the other side because the one wasn't moving. So I was finally able to talk, but I had no vocal range. And they said that you may never, you may always be paralyzed and, all this kind of stuff. So it was a really tough time. A lot of prayer and a lot of reflection on how much singing means to you. Because I think I'd kind of taken all this for granted. Kind of you do music your whole life and you don't really think about what an opportunity you have to what I trained myself to do through the years and the ability to sing and it's just heartbreaking to hear other vocalists out there singing. You can't hit those notes and stuff. But I had my instruments, so it really gave me a time to appreciate the fact that I wasn't just a singer, I was also a musician, so no matter, I could still keep playing music. And after 6 months, miracles, it started, there was movement in it, so and it's gotten better since, and now I'm better than I ever have been as far as vocal stamina and all and range and everything, so I'm very grateful for that.
Thank you.
She loved the sheriff's only son, the love of John he bought her. She met the sheriff's giant pride, they met in darkness late. Well, John he met his darker side, and they all would meet their fate. Running, but he's not a coward, always hiding from his crime. A step away from being devoured, just a victim of his time. He runs the night, his guns are blazing, and knows the sheriff won't forgive. Hell-bent on hell-raising, he'll live or die a fugitive.
Singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and author Mary James, Mean Mary. On Friday night, June 5th at 8 o'clock, she'll perform at one of the area's newest venues, the Muddy Creek Music Hall in historic Bethania Mill in Winston-Salem. They're located at 5455 Bethania Road. You'll find links to more information, Mary's recordings, and book titled Wherefore Art Thou Jane at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
She wore a dress that Johnny bought, she wore it for the sun. The sun, he wore a yellow spot, and Johnny wore a gun. The sheriff's son turned pale with fright, he turned tail and played. Johnny's gun turned out his light and turned his yellow red. Running, but he's not a coward, always hiding from his crime. A step away from being devoured, just a victim of his time. Sirens screaming, guns are blazing, and all the sheriff won't forgive. Hell-bent on hell-raising, he'll live or die a fugitive. Running, but he's not a coward, always hiding from his crime. A step away from being devoured, just a victim of his time. He runs the night, his guns are blazing, and all the sheriff won't forgive. Hell-bent on hell-raising, he'll live or die a fugitive.
On to the wide, wide world of opera we go. The American Singers Opera Project, ASOP, is underway on the campus of Wake Forest University, and opera fans, as well as the opera curious, can get a local taste of what's going on there on Friday, June 5th at 7 o'clock at the Arbor Acres Retirement Community during ASOP's first aria evening. There'll be a repeat performance on Saturday night, the 6th, at Salem Town. Then ASOP's production of Hansel and Gretel with Chamber Orchestra comes to the Brendel Recital Hall on the Wake Forest University campus. American Singers Opera Project, ASOP, is one of the most affordable programs in the country called Pay to Sings. ASOP is unique in that it offers a full opera production each summer with chamber orchestra. Artistic director, American soprano Barbara DeMaio Caprilli, says it's also the only program that offers no upper age limit with singers from high school to college student level to professors of voice looking to learn a new role. Wake Forest University professor of music, lyric tenor Richard Hurd, says that aspect of their summer program offers opportunities for both singers and ASOP instructors, many of whom are leaders in their field.
Well, you know, it's great having a chance to work with the younger singers. It's just really exciting, you know, having a chance to toss out ideas to see if they work. And then it's great having an older singer who's been there already, and you can kind of be a little bit more intense when you're teaching them.
From the student perspective, I mean, they're hearing all these sounds swirling around them. Is it intimidating for the youngsters to be hearing someone, say, a professor or an advanced student singing?
No, I think it's more inspiring for the youngsters, and for the older singers who've been around a while, it's a lot of fun for them to see the enthusiasm that the young singers bring. Everybody grows from it, and they end up kind of adopting the younger ones and ushering them along the way, as it were.
Yeah.
And they stay in touch afterwards, too. We have Facebook pages, and we give everybody all of their email addresses. And I've seen on Facebook quite a few of the participants from the last years congratulating others on things like getting into master's work or getting a job at an important opera house. And that's kind of nice, too. We're creating a community.
That's something in the opera world that I noticed as a musician in the orchestra. Your paths cross in the professional world so often. You can't really burn bridges. It seems like the folks just get along.
Yes, this is something we actually talk to our participants about, is how important it is to be a good colleague. And in fact, just the other night I said, look at the people around you. These are the people you're going to be singing with for the rest of your lives.
Thank you.
that really gets at the mission of Aesop in a sense. And we're not dealing with people that just like to sing on a whim. I mean, this is real professional training.
It is. And, you know, it's experiences they may not get anywhere else because, you know, we're so intense and then we love the excitement that we see in the singer's eyes. And speaking to the success of our program, we have 4 returning singers from last year in the program this summer.
Well, that says a lot. And I think the excitement of being able to put on, knowing that you're going to be performing in an opera every time you come is really amazing. And this year, Hansel and Gretel, the Engelbert Humperdinck classic and great story to boot. Why this opera? And it'll be sung in English.
It'll be sung in English. The reason we're doing it in English is because it's a children's opera and we want to make sure that people know that it's very child-friendly. It's a wonderful translation from the Schott score, S-C-H-O-T-T, Schott score. And we're doing it in English also because we wanted to be able to appeal to younger singers who might not be able to do something in German. So we have a little bit younger group this year. And then in the past, it's a bit younger.
Not getting so caught up in the diction, and the German would give you a chance to free up and focus on different aspects of singing.
It's also a comedy, you know. I mean, it's a strange comedy because somebody dies at the end, but it's a witch that dies at the end. And
she had
turns,
it coming.
And she had it coming, yeah. She turns into a cookie, so that's okay. And it's a very interesting production. Michael Campman, our director, came up with this concept of setting it at turn of the century New York. And the witch is an aging diva who has her house in the middle of the rambles of Central Park.
How about that? That is a twist. I'm a student. I attend American Singers Opera Project. What's your wish for me? What do you hope I get out of the experience?
We hope that you find your passion. The passion may not be opera, but we hope you figure that out in the 2 weeks. That you either want to go ahead and do this, or that maybe it isn't for you. And we've had both results. Because it's a very intense 2 weeks, you learn a lot. But we hope to give you a very professional experience. So you're expected to be on time, you're expected to arrive with your music learned, and sometimes they don't, but they realize that they need to, and they go ahead, and they get better, and all is well. And sometimes they say, you know, this is a lot of work. I don't really like it that much. And they do something else. We have an ex-Aesop person who's now a leading pastry chef in Chicago because she figured out it wasn't her passion, and she went back and found something that was her passion.
Richard, how about you? From your perspective, what do you hope your students get out of the experience?
Well, I hope they get a new discovery, maybe something they've never encountered before, a new experience. And as Barbara just said, they discover if this is for me or maybe not for me. You know, what I would like for them to discover is a new love for what they do, a new passion. Even if they had passion before, now they're more passionate about it. And mainly it's just, I think they also discover where their strengths and their weaknesses are. And they can leave here with a better idea of how to sort of address those with their teacher when they go back to their various universities.
American Singers Opera Project, AESOP, Artistic Director, American Soprano, Barbara DiMaio Caprilli, and Wake Forest University Professor of Music, Lyric Tenor Richard Hurd. This year, AESOP performances begin Friday, June 5th at 7 o'clock at Arbor Acres Retirement Community during AESOP's first Aria Evening. There'll be a repeat performance on Saturday night, the 6th, at Salem Town. Then, AESOP's production of Hansel and Gretel with Chamber Orchestra gets underway at Brendel Recital Hall on the Wake Forest University campus. There'll be Thursday, June 11th through the 13th, with evening concerts Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7, and a 2 o'clock matinee on Saturday in Wake Forest's Ring Theater. Tickets are just $10, and performances are free for all Wake Forest faculty, staff, and students with ID. AESOP is a not-for-profit funded by fees collected from singers, and you can find out how you can help keep the program affordable for talented singers at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts and photos for all the artists and events featured on the show, as well as archived episodes. They're at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.